Today is Monday, February 13th. We're going to be wrapping up Chapter 4 information and starting Chapter 5. So we've spent some time talking about various tissues, and so inflammation on page 50 begins our discussion of how tissues repair themselves if they're damaged. So at the top of the page, what I'd like to do is start with a discussion of what kinds of tissues heal quickly versus what kinds of tissues are very poor or slow to heal. So what you may want to think about is some of the tissues that are exposed to the environment. What kind of tissue covers and lines your body surface?
Epithelial.
That is one I would place in the heal quickly column. So when we think about skin cancers and other types of cancers, they most commonly affect our epithelial tissues. In fact, if you think about lung cancer, breast cancer, prostate cancer, cervical cancer, uterine cancer, ovarian cancer, we can just keep listing. Those are all epithelial tissue cancers. So the reason for that is because epithelial tissues grow fast, they repair themselves quickly, and they're exposed to things in the environment that can induce cancer formation. So, you know, we think about chemicals that we're exposed to, cigarette smoke, other kinds of chemicals like that that are in the atmosphere. Those come in contact with not only our skin, but also our internal body structures, and they can cause cancer. So that fast growth in combination with what those tissues are exposed to means that epithelial tissues are most commonly the ones that form cancers. So they do quickly heal, that's good news for us, but the bad news is they can form cancers easily because they're growing so fast. Let's see, connective tissues, let's take that category next. Loose connective tissues are going to be ones that heal quickly. They've got a good blood supply. But you know, in contrast, epithelial tissues have no direct blood supply. They have no blood vessels of their own. They borrow the blood supply from the neighboring connective tissue, which may often be something like a loose connective tissue. Where would you place dense connective tissues like tendons and ligaments?
Slow.
Slow, yeah, definitely put those in the slow to heal category. They have a blood supply, it's just that they're so tightly packed it becomes very difficult to get healing agents in and heal those tissues. How about cartilage? Where would you place that one? Yes, slow. I would put blood under the quick to heal category because in terms of healing, blood is actually the healing agent. So you've got to have quick responsive bone marrow to make new blood cells. Also, I'd put under the quick to heal category bone tissue because bone tissue does grow and repair rather quickly too. You don't have the choice when you break something what you're going to break. But if you had the choice of breaking something, the bone would be the better thing to break because it heals more quickly. Heal time for bone is usually like 4 to 6 weeks for a younger person. Cartilage, unfortunately, means that we may involve surgery to repair that broken cartilage. Since cartilage is avascular, it's going to be very slow to heal compared to the comparable bone tissue. Bone tissue is really avascular, so there's going to be a great supply of blood bringing in healing agents, and that's what we're looking for. Let's talk about muscle tissues. We have three types. What are they?
Skeletal and cardiac.
Good. Skeletal, cardiac, and smooth. Which one of those three do you think heals quickly?
Smooth
muscle. Good. Can you tell me some locations of smooth muscle? Hollow organs, good. So if they cut through, say, your intestine for a repair surgery, that muscle tends to heal pretty quick. By contrast, skeletal muscle and cardiac muscle are slow to heal. So it's not that skeletal and cardiac have a poor blood supply, they have a great blood supply. So the blood supply is not the issue here. What the issue is the type of cells that make new tissues grow. And skeletal and cardiac muscle tissue are made from these cells called satellite cells. And so cardiac muscle, for instance, has very few of those. If you damage cardiac muscle tissue, say through a heart attack, that tissue is going to be very poor to slow to heal, if at all. And that's why people with heart muscle tissue damage oftentimes have lifelong trouble after a cardiac event. There are very few cells that make and grow new cardiac muscle tissue. Well, there's only one category left, and that's nervous tissue. Where would you place that one? That's slow to heal. Why do you think that's the case? They just don't heal very quick, right? And again, it's not necessarily the blood supply. It's rather the issue of cells that are there to grow. There are support cells called neuroglia that can grow and repair damaged nervous tissue, but neuroglia don't send nerve impulses. It's the neurons that send nerve impulses, and if they're damaged, they unfortunately don't heal very well, especially if you're older than, say, mid-teenage years. There's a certain amount of plasticity with your nervous system up until your middle teenage years, but after that, your nervous system becomes a little more set in its place and less likely to heal and repair itself. So let's talk about the process of inflammation. That's going to come next on your page. Let's say you've got something simple like a paper cut. There's nothing simple about that, right? Those are pretty painful. So when you have something like a paper cut, one of the first things that's going to happen is a process of inflammation. And so you'll notice that we have blood vessels that are cut. Bleeding can occur. You'll notice that we also have pooled blood there starting to collect in that cut area. So involved in this bleeding is actually a bunch of chemicals that are going to help us heal this cut and keep it, you know, hopefully healthy. So on your sheet there, the first step says that mast cells release histamine. So have you heard of histamine or antihistamines before? Okay, so histamines make the blood vessels leaky. They allow for blood and its helper agents, such as antibodies, for instance, to leak into that damaged area. And so that's a way for us to prevent any kind of infection or further damage to occur to an area that's received some inflammation, some cut. So you can see here that histamine actually makes our blood vessels dilate, which means they get bigger in size, and that allows for a lot of those healing agents like blood cells and antibodies to escape the bloodstream. We normally think of histamine as being our enemy because it makes us itch, it makes us have swollen, painful areas, but in fact, histamine is a helper for this process. So why would you take an antihistamine?
Allergic reaction.
Allergic reaction, right. Those cells that release histamine may dump too much histamine, and that can cause a drop in blood pressure. And so that drop in blood pressure can lead to a type of shock we call, anybody know? Anaphylactic, right. So unfortunately, when those basophil white blood cells release copious amounts of histamine, that can cause all sorts of problems. So yeah, histamine reactions are not fun. I know you've had one before. If you've had an itchy mosquito bite, that's partly a histamine reaction. If you have itchy, watery eyes during allergy season, that's also histamine giving you part of that itchy, inflamed red eye crap. You know, so that is not something we enjoy having, but it's very much a part of the healing process. Okay, so the next thing you'll notice there is if you've got damaged tissue, that there's going to be some white blood cells move in that are going to help heal this area. So there may in fact be dead cells that need to be cleaned up, and those dead cells are called a necrosis. So we don't necessarily want those dead cells left behind. So you can see in the migration portion here, those white blood cells migrate in, and it's their job to clean up those dead tissues and dead cells. otherwise that stuff is called necrosis. Okay, so what is pus? Collection of dead white blood cells and other dead cells. So we know when we see pus that that's an area that's hopefully being healed, but it is a collection of dead white blood cells. Now, the problem is if you have an area that is not able to drain to the outside world, that area then becomes called an abscess. So an abscess would be an area of collection of pus or white blood cells that can't drain. And unfortunately, in some cases, that may need to be lanced open so that the drainage can occur. Otherwise, what happens to an abscess if you don't let it drain? Gets infected, right. So that may become worse of a problem than just lancing it. Little sneak preview here for your upcoming Bio 211 course. There are white blood cells called macrophages that move into this area. They help to eat and digest bacteria, viruses, dead cells. So they're part of the solution in helping to solve, you know, an inflammation issue here. You already know about fibroblasts. What are they doing here? Growing fibers. Good. And the most common fiber type? Yeah, collagen. So collagen is largely what those fibroblasts are growing back into that area. So these are the four cardinal signs of inflammation: red, hot, swollen, and painful tissue. We often sense it on our skin, but inflammation can occur in joints. Inflammation can also occur around organs. Okay, so it's not just on your skin. This is any tissue that's inflamed. May be red, hot, swollen, or painful to the touch. So, what do you see as the benefit of inflammation? Well, it sends a local signal, yeah, to that area to heal. And what do we gain by having inflamed tissue? What comes to the area to help?
More blood.
More blood, yeah. What does that blood have in it that's helpful to us?
White blood cells.
White blood cells, yeah. Macrophages, fibroblasts, histamine helps attract more blood to that area. So as uncomfortable inflammation is for us, it is certainly a healing, or part of that healing process and getting that tissue repaired. Okay, so let's talk about repair down below. We've already talked about the fibroblasts that migrate into this area. Those fibroblasts are often growing back collagen fibers. And if you leave behind the collagen fibers and don't further repair the tissue, what you've got is scar tissue. So sometimes if the tissue is quick to repair, that scar tissue is then replaced by normal cells and normal tissues. For instance, if this was skin and you had a cut that went down into the dermis, you'd want to replace it with things like sweat glands and oil glands and sensory organs. But unfortunately, if you happen to have a pretty bad cut, you may only leave scar tissue behind. So what type of fiber forms scar tissue?
Collagen.
Collagen. So collagen is strong, it's somewhat flexible, but it does not have all the characteristics of normal tissue. So, you know, it's nice to leave behind, but it's not certainly what you want to have there. You want to heal it with normal tissue types. Okay, so there's actually been several phases we've skipped through here: maturation, proliferation, and the whole migration process. We're going to cover that again in detail when we talk about skin, because that's going to be very relevant to our skin discussion. So we'll pick this whole topic back up a little later on, probably either Wednesday or next Monday. Do you have questions so far? Okay, let's talk about membranes. They're over on page 51. So let's build the human body. We start off with building blocks for living organisms called cells. Cells of the similar type work together to form what? Tissues, good. Tissues of similar types work together to make
organs,
good. And that's where we're at. Membranes are simple organs.
And in fact, there are two major types. There's epithelial membranes and there are connective membranes. The name tells you a lot about what you need to know. Epithelial membranes cover and line some body surface, whether inside or out. And connective membranes do what they say, which is to connect body parts together. The examples of our epithelial membranes are here, cutaneous, mucous, and serous membranes. And there's only one example of a connective membrane, and that is a synovial membrane. So let's talk about cutaneous membranes first. These cutaneous membranes are an example of an epithelial membrane. And you'll notice that like all other epithelial membranes, they have two tissue types, and that is epithelial tissue and, of course, connective tissue. So in this picture, can you tell me what specific type of epithelial tissue we've got?
Good.
So the top part, stratified squamous, apical surface near the top of your picture here, and this curvy bottom is your basement membrane. Where do you think the oldest cells are located?
At the top,
near that apical surface. The newest cells just having emerged from mitosis are down here near this basement membrane. This underlying tissue is connective tissue. What specific type?
Dense irregular.
Good. So you notice all these wavy looking collagen fibers arranged irregularly, and the nuclei here are actually cells called fibroblast. Good. So you got fibroblast nuclei down there in that dense irregular connective tissue. Now, instead of just saying we've got epithelial and connective and talking about them separately, we're going to say this entire picture is a cutaneous membrane, and it's specifically a type called skin. So, of course, we know where skin is located on the outside of our bodies. That tells us something else. That epithelial tissue happens to be what? It is keratinized, right? So what is keratin?
Waterproofing,
good. So it is meant to be a fibrous, tough protein. It accumulates on your outer epithelial tissues. It is meant to keep you from drying out or from taking on water. The more likely problem is going to be drying out. So this is a keratinized cutaneous membrane. All cutaneous membranes, in fact, are keratinized. So on your sheet there, it says, what makes these membranes dry? It's keratin. Yep, it's keratin. So in this picture, you can actually see a layer of keratin or several layers of keratin on the outermost surface. That keratin is meant to be a waterproofing layer. All of this thin stuff is the keratin out there. So it's dry, dead, packed skin cells. Let's talk about, did you get it? Let's talk about moist mucous membranes. And the first thing I want to mention is the spelling of the word mucus. When you're talking about the sticky stuff that's in your nasal cavity, we spell that sticky stuff M-U-C-U-S. But when you're talking about a membrane that secretes the sticky mucus, we actually spell that word M-U-C-O-U-S. So, you know, when you're seeing it spelled two different ways, I didn't want you to think there's a misspelling at one of those points. In fact, the sticky stuff, the actual secretion, is M-U-C-U-S, but the membrane that makes mucus has an O in it, okay? So you might remind yourself that that's kind of like a goblet cell. Goblet cells, of course, secrete mucus, and those membranes are called mucous membranes. They're moist in nature. So you do not find mucous membranes on the outside of your body. You find these on the insides. In fact, the body cavities that open to the exterior are going to have moist mucous membranes lining them. So let's think about all the body cavities that open to the exterior. Around our head, we have our nasal cavity,
That's all lined with moist mucous membrane. That pseudostratified ciliated columnar epithelial, that's moist, okay? How about our digestive tract? What kind of tissue lines the mouth?
Stratified
squamous, yeah. That is moist mucous membrane. It's non-keratinized. It's meant to be moist because we help to lubricate the passage of food starting right there in the mouth. Take it all the way through. If you think about the entire pathway of your nasal cavity, all down to the throat, the trachea, the bronchi, and into the lungs, that is all lined with some type of moist mucous membrane. The specific tissue type may change, but overall, it's all moist mucous membrane. Thinking about your digestive tract, we know it's stratified squamous lining the inside of the mouth. Go down to your stomach, what do we have there? Simple columnar, good. Intestines, same thing. So all the lining of your digestive tract from mouth to anus is also moist mucous membrane. The specific tissue type may change, but overall it's all moist and it's lubricated with mucus. So on your sheet there, I did want to draw your attention to the purpose of mucus. It's actually got a few different functions. Can you tell me one? Lubrication is one. Protection is another one. And so how does mucus protect us? Yeah, making sure nothing scrapes, that's good.
Abrasions.
Another thing that mucus does is it attracts bacteria, and once they're stuck, they can't get free, so it is a great way to trap bacteria. So lubrication, protection, traps bacteria. So we don't normally think about having mucus in our digestive tract, but in fact, there's a lot of it there to help the food be lubricated and pass through without being, you know, stuck against a dry membrane. And of course, that mucus there helps to trap bacteria before it gets into our bloodstream. So we commonly attribute mucus to our respiratory systems, but in fact, it is found in the digestive system too.
And this would be columnar?
That would be columnar, yep, sure would be. In fact, that's probably a better one. Let's see, other systems that contain moist mucous membrane, urinary system pathways or moist mucous membrane, even though it's transitional, and of course the lining of reproductive tracts, especially in females, inside of the uterus, the vagina, all of that is moist mucous membrane. Let's talk about serous membranes. They are not serous, there's no I in there, but these are coverings for the outsides of organs. So I want to make a point here. The body cavities that open to the outside world are lined with mucous membrane. So if you've got a hole for a particular body cavity, that opening to the exterior is lined with moist mucous membrane. Now, serous membranes, on the other hand, do not open to the outside world. These are in the closed body cavity spaces of your thoracic cavity and your abdominopelvic cavity. So you can't touch a serous membrane like you can put your finger in your mouth and feel a moist mucous membrane. Okay, so serous membranes cover and line the outsides of organs in closed body cavities. Each serous membrane has two layers. Each layer is made up of simple squamous epithelial tissue. Really, really thin, okay? So each of the layers is made up of simple squamous epithelial tissue. The outermost of the two serous membrane layers is called the parietal layer. The parietal layer is actually anchored to the body cavity wall. The visceral layer, however, is attached directly to the organ that's being covered, and the word viscera means organ. That might be a great way to keep it straight. Viscera means organ. Now, Now, between those two serous membrane layers is a type of fluid called serous fluid. This fluid is meant to help lubricate around the outsides of the organs. So on your blank down there, the purpose of serous fluid is lubrication and to reduce friction. Lubrication and to reduce friction. Let's repeat what we just went through. Serous membranes are two layers. They're composed of simple squamous epithelial tissue. There is an underlying connective tissue, but they're really, really thin layers, and they have to glide and slide past each other because the whole goal of a serous membrane is to reduce friction. Now, there is not air space between the two layers. In fact, that serous fluid is between the two layers, but they often use a balloon as an analogy for a serous membrane. These membranes cover the outside organs, not the insides. And you can see this heart here is being wrapped by serous membranes. What is the innermost of the two layers called?
Visceral.
Good. And the outermost of the two? Good. Now, which one is directly anchored to your body cavity wall?
Parietal.
Yep. So the outermost parietal is anchored to your body cavity wall. The innermost visceral layer is actually anchored directly to your organ. I kind of think of it like shrink wrap. If you bought a product from a store that has plastic wrapping that's really hard to get off because it's been shrunk to the product, that's kind of like visceral serous membrane or visceral pericardium in this case, very tightly anchored to the underlying tissue type. So why don't we flip the page and I'll share with you three kinds of serous membranes.
Now, I don't go to sleep while the lights are off. It'll be nice and relaxing, right? Three types of serous membranes all begin with a P. This one, peritoneum, covers the digestive organs. It is an outermost covering. Okay, so its job is to cover the digestive organs. Yeah, wrap around digestive organs.
Digestive.
This peritoneum is actually visceral that you're looking at in this picture here. And you can have it on the outside of your stomach. You have it on the outside of your pancreas to some extent, a little bit on your liver. But a big place where you can really see the peritoneum is covering the outside of the digestive organs, like the small and large intestine. So when you all get to Bio-211 and cut open the CAD, you'll actually get an opportunity to see this mesentery, which is just another name for the visceral peritoneum. So all this shiny, clear stuff that looks like saran wrap, that's all visceral peritoneum. And you'll notice there's blood vessels traveling through that stuff. Over here, you've got the small intestine or the large intestine, okay? So, you know, it's all kind of hooked together. It's not like you have 25 feet of tube in your abdominal cavity. You have 25 feet of tube that's been held together by this wrapping of peritoneum. I want to emphasize this is not the inside covering. The inside of the organ is actually mucous membrane. This is an outermost covering that's meant to help protect those organs from rubbing and frictioning against each other. So there's a look at the mesentery. A word of warning for appendicitis. If you have an appendicitis attack, it can spread through the mesentery or visceral peritoneum, which you notice here affects all the way up to the stomach and the liver. So that can cause really bad problems if it can spread throughout that mesentery, and it can. I had a student a few years ago, and her husband battled appendicitis cancer. May never have heard of that before. It is a rare form of cancer. His appendix had ruptured. It spread cancer cells throughout this mesentery or visceral peritoneum. It formed tumors on the outsides of his organs. He had to have multiple surgeries, taking an organ piece out here, an organ piece out there. And eventually it just got to be too much. And he was in his mid-40s when he passed away from appendicitis cancer. We oftentimes don't think about appendicitis having cancer cells in there, but in his case it did. Yeah, that's just awful. Okay, so the pleura is covering around what organs?
Lungs,
good. There is a visceral pleura that is the innermost lining. The parietal pleura is anchored to what? The thoracic wall, good, that body cavity wall, that thoracic cavity wall. And this is actually going to be an important part of how we understand how respiration occurs in the next chapter. Respiration relies on those two layers being intact. If you have excess fluid or even air between those two layers, that can cause your lungs to collapse. So these are really important layers around the outside of your heart or lungs. Speaking of the heart, of course, the heart does have its own covering too. This one's called what?
Pericardium.
Good. So you've got pericardium around the heart, pleura around the lungs, peritoneum around the digestive organ. Do you have any questions on those three? Okay. So here's a picture of the pericardium. You've got letter A peeled back and letter B covering the heart itself. Can you tell me which layer is your serous, or let's see, your visceral serous membrane?
B.
Good. So how did you know? Yeah, good. It's actually adhered to the actual organ. Letter A is peeled back. That must be the parietal, right? And that, in fact, is parietal being peeled back. You can see there's a bit of space between those two layers, and that's where we have the serous fluid, because we want to reduce the friction, allow for those organs to glide and slide past each other when they're filling with air or beating with, you know, pumping blood. Okay. Our last membrane is not epithelial in nature. In fact, the connective membrane, called a synovial membrane, is made only of connective tissues. So this is our only example of connective membranes, the synovial membrane, which is found lining your joint cavities. And there I said a no-no word, right? Did you catch it? Lining. So normally when you hear the word lining, what should you think of? Not connective. Epithelial, yeah. So even though it lines your joint cavities, it is not epithelial in nature. It is in fact connective. Okay, so these are your movable joints, like your elbow, your shoulder, wrist, fingers, also found in your hip, knee, toes, ankles. Okay, so that's not all the joints in your body, that's just a sampling of joints. But these particular ones have connective tissues and membranes forming a synovial capsule. Synovial fluid and serous fluid have the same job, and that is to reduce friction. What makes them different is where they're located. Synovial fluid is located in joints and reduces joint friction. So I'm hoping you've seen The Wizard of Oz at some point in your lifetime. You've probably seen them oil up the Tin Man so you can get moving. That's what synovial fluid does. It oils up those joints, reduces the friction. And so without it, you're going to have bone rubbing against bone or cartilage rubbing against cartilage, which is not a good idea in either case. So this could be your elbow, for instance. You've got cartilage that should protect the ends of those bones, but this space in between should be cushioned by that synovial fluid. That's hopefully going to help reduce friction in those joints.
Okay. Right before they do like a knee replacement, you can have injections to not necessarily replace the cartilage, but it kind of, it's like a gel. Is that what they're doing, is actually putting some of this fluid in there, or is it actually going to be to replace the, kind of pushing the cartilage?
That might be something to help keep the cartilages from rubbing against each other, so it might be replacement synovial fluid or something similar. Yeah. Hey, good time to review. There's a ligament. What kind of tissue makes the ligament?
Dense rectum.
Dense rectum, good. Is that connective, epithelial, muscle?
Connective.
Connective, good, good. Okay.
So if you've ever heard of bursitis or had bursitis, it's an inflammation of little sacs around your joints. Bursitis is actually an inflammation of synovial fluid sacs that are meant to provide cushioning around those movable joints. So some people get steroid shots to reduce inflammation from bursitis, and so bursitis can be painful and caused by overuse activity, such as tennis elbow or, you know, overuse of a shoulder if you're often riding by hand. So overuse activities can often lead to bursitis or inflammation of those joints. Okay, so looks like we're done there with chapter 4. How about questions so far? Well, there's a parietal peritoneum that's outer and the visceral peritoneum that's the inner of the two layers. So, like in this picture, you've got, you're only looking at visceral peritoneum because it covers the organs. There is a parietal peritoneum, but it's anchored to your abdominopelvic cavity wall. So let's say they were going to cut somebody open to do surgery. When they cut the muscle tissue open and peel back that cavity, they're actually going to peel back the parietal peritoneum.
Okay, so this one parietal is just describing what part of the peritoneum?
That's right, which layer we're referencing.
And here's the same thing with peritoneum.
Correct, yeah. Okay. There's visceral parietal for every one of those. How about any other questions on tissues or membranes or the healing process? Why don't we take a look at some skin information over on page 54. All right, so this is our integumentary system. So surface area-wise, this is our largest system. It covers over 20 square feet of body surface, so no wonder we're concerned when someone has, say, skin damage from a burn, for instance. So about 20 square feet of coverage, that's a lot of tissue space that this particular system covers. By the way, this is our first organ system, and when we're thinking about organ systems, we're thinking about various organs and tissues that work together for a common purpose. There are about 11 organ systems that you'll cover throughout Bio 210 and 211, and so now you've encountered your first organ system. Okay, so at the top of the page there, you'll notice that there are two layers that compose our skin, the epidermis and the dermis. Those are two tissue types that contribute to the cutaneous membrane that forms our integumentary system. But skin is just more than epidermis and dermis. What else would you find as part of your integumentary system? Glands, good. Your nails, good. What else? You still gotta have blood flow. Yeah, you gotta have vessels going through.
Hair.
Good. Okay, so we've got glands, hair, nails. We have an epidermis and a dermis. And so all of that is what we consider together the integumentary system. There's a lot going on here. So if when you're thinking about functions for this system, what would one really important function be?
Protection.
Definitely protection, good. So we're gonna discover many ways your skin protects underlying tissues. So why don't we start by discussing the epidermis? Because the epidermis is the outermost of our two skin layers, and of course that epi prefix tells us above or upon, it does sit above or upon the dermis. So what type of tissue forms the epidermis? Good. Stratified squamous. Is it keratinized or not? It's keratinized, good. And what's the function of keratin here? waterproof and good. Good. Okay, so let's talk about three types of cells that we're going to find in our epidermis. These three cells do contribute to protecting our underlying layers. I'm going to give you a moment to jot these down. They're in the order of the blanks on your worksheet. Keratinocytes are first, and then melanocytes, and Langerhans cells, sometimes called dendritic cells. Well, the first two cells tell you what they make. Keratinocytes make keratin, melanocytes make melanin. The third type isn't making anything. The third type is actually a white blood cell on patrol. So, of course, its name is named after somebody. That's why they're going with dendritic cell as an alternate name for the Langerhans cell.
Which one will we see on the test?
I'll probably put Langerhans because that's what we're using here.
And you said it's basically a patrol version of a white cell.
That's right. So the location of keratin can be a little tricky. We know it's on the outside surface of our epidermis, but that's not where it's made. Keratin is actually made down near the lowest level of your epidermis. It is shuffled up through the layers as those layers age. It's carried to the topmost layers, and the topmost layers of cells are nothing but dead keratin-filled cells. So don't get the idea that they're made up there at that topmost layer. Keratin molecules are actually made at the lowermost levels. So you can see that the keratin is accumulated here in this picture along the outermost portion of the epidermis, but in reality it's made down here in the same location that melanin is made. You can see in this picture that melanin is also accumulating in the lowermost levels of your epidermis. How do you know that this is the lowermost portion?
Is it in the basement?
It looks like your basement membrane, doesn't it? Besides, what is all this other stuff?
It's irregular.
Good, dense irregular connective tissue. So you know that right through the bottom portion here is where we transition to another tissue type. So melanocytes actually hang out down here in the bottommost portion of your epidermis, and there are cells called, or melanocytes produce little packets called melanosomes that travel to the topmost portion of your skin. So this is what a melanocyte looks like. It kind of has a spider-like appearance, and little arms break off and they form melanosomes. Those packets of melanin then go into a cell and they travel up through the layers as that skin ages and get pushed toward the surface. So if you happen to get some sun exposure, well, today would be a good day except it's in the winter time, right? But if you got some sun exposure and that caused more melanin production, it would take 2 to 4 weeks for that melanin to reach the topmost layers and get sloughed off. So you would experience 2 to 4 weeks of protection from the extra melanin, but that's about it because it's just going to be layered up as that skin cell gets pushed toward the top. So what color is melanin? It is a brownish, blackish pigment, right? Good. And do you know why it's there?
For protection.
Color
to the skin. It protects us from what?
UV rays.
UV rays, right. And where can you get UV rays from?
The sun.
The sun. And where else?
Tanning bed.
Tanning bed, that's right. So a couple of places where you can get UV radiation. Of course, sunlight is a great source of it. Tanning beds are another, not a great source of it. I want to tell you the difference between two types of UV radiation, just for your information. The UVA radiation can penetrate through your epidermis and your dermis, so it's not a very strong wave, but you'll notice the UVB waves penetrate through the epidermis only. So two types of waves there. You know, glass, say from your vehicle, can protect you from some of the UV radiation, but not all of it. So that's why wearing sunscreen year-round is actually recommended by the American Dermatological Association to prevent skin cancers and skin damage. So, yeah, that UV radiation is certainly something we want to be careful of having excess of. This is an interesting case of a man who drove a delivery truck for about 30 years. He is a North America resident, so that means that the sunlight was mostly coming in through the southern portion of his window. So being on the left side of the vehicle meant that the left side of his face got most of the sun exposure. What a huge difference, right?
So tanning can make you look like that?
Tanning could do that to you also, yeah. Yeah. Whether it's tanning bed or sunlight, either way, all extra sun exposure can make the collagen fibers break down and then the skin sags as a result. Yeah. So these are Langerhans cells. They are circled in this picture right there. They are kind of strange looking, but they're on patrol. They're looking for any kind of bacteria or something that may have entered through your epidermis that could potentially cause an infection. Well, there is no blood supply in your epidermis. How about your dermis? Does it have a blood supply? Yeah, so if a bacterium makes its way past the Langerhans cells into your dermis and hits the bloodstream, boom, now you've got a bacterium that can travel your blood supply and go anywhere in your body. So that's why we need to have these Langerhans cells present in the epidermis to stop infections before they take hold. As we age, those Langerhans cells are less common, and also as we age, our epidermis is less thick. So we're more likely to have skin infections the older we get. So, you know, that's another good reason to make sure that we stay healthy and limit our sun exposure, because that can also contribute to the breakdown of the epidermis or outermost skin layer. So in reality, that epidermis that contains these three cell types are actually no thicker than a piece of paper towel. So your epidermis, even though it's a thick portion of your skin, really isn't all that thick. It's about 30 to 50 layers of skin cells. That's all we've got protecting us from the outside world. More Langerhans cells here. Okay. These are the five layers of your epidermis. I'll give you a moment to jot these down. Okay, before you even think about what these layers are, let me tell you an easy way to remember them. From superficial to deep, you've got corneum, lucidum, granulosum, spinosum, and basal. You can say that Corny, Lucy's grandma, spent billions. Okay, or if you want to do it the other way, you can start from the most bottom layer and say better, students, give, love, and care. If you choose one of those to remember the layers, just keep in mind, are you doing it from top down or from bottoms up? Because it will make a difference come test time. So the corneum is the outermost layer. The basal is kind of like basement. That is the deepest layer of your epidermis. Why is there a star beside lucidum? Palms and soles, right. So it's only found in a couple of locations. Palms of your hands and soles of your feet. Sure. From the top down, Corny, Lucy's grandma spent billions. So from
top down, corny Lucy's grandma spent billions. From the deepest layer to the most superficial layer, you can say that better students give love and care. Okay, so from the bottom layer up, it's better students give love and care. So let's talk about those five layers. The corneum layer is actually the outermost layer made up of dead keratinized skin cells. It's an easy layer to remember because when people get corns and calluses, that comes from excess keratin in the corneum layer. Okay, so corns and calluses come from excess keratin in the corneum layer. You'll notice in this picture, you might be able to see from where you're sitting, little tiny things linking together those adjacent cells. Do you remember the type of cell junction that links together cells so they're not torn or ripped apart? They're bands, yes, of desmosomes. Yes, that's it, bands of desmosomes. So that's what keeps those cells literally linked to their neighbor. So when you lose skin cells, they're not coming off one by one, they're coming off linked to their neighbors. So oftentimes in layers, okay? So you might be able to see them, right there they are. Those are desmosomes linking together those skin cells to their neighbors. Stratum lucidum is only found in certain parts of your body. That's on the palms of your hands and soles of your feet. Why do we find stratum lucidum in those locations? Roughest part of your skin, right? That's the place where you're going to get a lot of abrasion. So you need a little extra thickness there in the way of about 4 to 6 additional skin cell layers. So that helps to provide some cushioning for those particular body regions. Granulosum is our next layer down. You still have some keratinocytes in this layer, but they're mostly beginning to die. So from granulosum on up toward the surface is where you find dead skin cells. Spinosum is down below, and spinosum has these cells that look almost cuboidal or even columnar in shape. So these are actively dividing keratinocytes and melanocytes. At the very bottom layer, you've got stratum basal. These are also your actively dividing cells. They're the ones undergoing mitosis. Those new cells will then drift up through the layers for the next 2 to 4 weeks. By the time those cells in stratum basal reach the very topmost of your corneum layer, it's about 2 to 4 weeks later, and they're dead, and they're sloughed off as dandruff or just as skin flakes. So it's interesting to note that most of the dust in your home is actually from your stratum corneum layer. So, you know, that dust that we sweep up or vacuum up is from stratum corneum. There's trillions of cells being sloughed off every day from that stratum corneum layer. Yeah, it's really a nasty thought, isn't it? And imagine back in the day when people didn't wash clothes or bed sheets very frequently. Imagine how much skin dust got accumulated in those types of items. So in reality, here's stratum corneum. It's a rather thick outermost layer. This is stratum lucidum. It's lucid or clear. And that's why it shows up very nicely in some of these pictures. So where do you find lucidum only?
Palms
and soles. Good. This granulosum layer always tends to be rather dark. It has an accumulation of melanin in it, and that will of course spread as you go up through the layers. Underneath that, you've got spinosum. Those cells actually take on somewhat of a spiny appearance. They are linked together with desmosomes for the travel upward. And then the very most bottom layer is undergoing mitosis as well. That's your stratum basal. That's your basement membrane or your bottommost layer. Okay. So I want you to notice the junction between your epidermis and your underlying dermis. It is not a smooth, continuous one. Rather, it looks more like a groovy egg crate appearance. What is the purpose for that?
Looks like maybe
lock them in, yeah. So if you've got two flat layers with no locking mechanism, they can slide and glide past one another, and you can actually lubricate off the epidermis, which is what happens if you wear a pair of shoes that you're not used to wearing, like a brand new pair of shoes. Now, the goal here is to keep the two layers, epidermis and dermis, locked in, and so you've got this groovy appearance to the bottommost layer of stratum basal. Every picture we look at is going to have a groovy stratum basal. That helps to keep it linked in with your underlying dermis. Okay, so you can actually pick out the five layers. You know, you've got your corneum out here. This dark layer is always your stratum granulosum, spinosum, and then the very most bottom layer, that's your stratum basal. So you can actually figure on those four layers or five layers being all of our skin regions. All right. So let's turn to the bottom of the page there and talk about pigmentation that we may find with our epidermis. I'm going to start you off with some common types first. We've all heard of beta carotene in orange or yellow vegetables. So beta carotene is actually a particular vitamin. Which vitamin?
It's a vitamin.
Yeah. Just checking to see if you're reading right. Okay. So when you hear about vitamin A is alternately called beta carotene. Beta carotene is common in yellow and orange vegetables. Carrots are a good source. What are some other good sources?
Squash.
Squash and pumpkin, yep, sweet potatoes and yams.
What about oranges?
Orange is good, yeah. Okay, so if you eat a lot of beta-carotene-rich foods, and I mean a lot of beta-carotene-rich foods, then you can actually stain your skin orange to yellow, and it accumulates in little packets in your stratum basal that will spend the next 2 to 4 weeks traveling upward through your levels of strata. And after about a month of time, it gets sloughed off at the topmost layer. So sometimes people who have kids that love carrots, for instance, well, those kids will gorge on carrots, and that's all they want to eat day in, day out is carrots. And they can actually accumulate the carotene in their skin like you see in the picture here. A lot of times parents think that those kids have got jaundice, but it's a little too orange for jaundice. And then once they figure out that the kid's been eating a bunch of orange carrots, they say, ah, you know, you've got beta carotene in your skin, give it a month time, and it will be gone and sloughed off. So it's a harmless thing, it just happens to stain you orange from the inside out. Buyer beware, there are tanning pills on the market that are nothing but beta carotene. For people who think that they can take the tanning pill and tan their skin, well, the joke is that it actually turns you orange in color. So beta carotene actually will stain you orange from the inside out. Once you stop taking it, give it a month's time, because that's how long it takes for those layers to slough off from stratum corneum. Now, certain populations, Asian populations, actually naturally produce beta carotene and have it in their skin, but otherwise, you know, other populations just don't have beta carotene or that orange yellow coloration. We've talked about melanin already. This is a pigmentation that everyone produces. Whether you're black, white, yellow, red, no matter your skin coloration, you do produce a certain amount of melanin, because what is the function of this particular pigment? Good, protect from UV radiation, right. So to make vitamin D, you actually have to have enough sun exposure. And the sun exposure for vitamin D is actually linked to your bone health. So we're going to kind of get into that conversation about why excess skin sun exposure can actually reduce your bone health. So there's a link there between bones, vitamin D, and melanin production. Let's flip the page and talk about another kind of pigmentation.
This one is hemoglobin. So the blood that travels through your vessels in the dermis, not the epidermis, contains blood cells with hemoglobin. Hemoglobin turns a bright red when it binds what? Oxygen, right. So the bright red color can sometimes shine through your skin. It can give your skin a pinkish or a reddish tone, especially if you're hot or if you're embarrassed. So that red coloration of hemoglobin can actually glow through your skin. If there's a lack of hemoglobin transporting oxygen, we actually don't see red, we see a different color. What color would that be? That'd be blue, yeah. So even though you don't necessarily have blue blood ever, it is the trick of the eye that combines a dark red tint of the skin with the melanin that makes your eye perceive it as somewhat blue in color. So there is never actually a case where you have blue blood. It's just a combination of dark red blood and melanin color. So when you see cyanosis or blue coloration, what's actually going on?
Yeah. Have you ever seen that man in Florence that had a green?
I have not seen him, but I have heard stories about him for years.
What, the guy was blue?
Yeah.
He's actually going to turn
turtle. Oh, does he really? Is silver nitrate?
Yeah, he looks just like him.
Wow.
Yeah, he's on the south side of town.
Okay. And I know there was apparently a guy in Darlington, too, that has this same phenomenon. This is not having anything to do with hemoglobin or cyanosis. This is actually silver nitrate. Some people take it for, you know, like a supplement, but unfortunately it can stain the skin blue. This man was well known as having taken that particular supplement and died recently, not from this, but from heart issues. I did want to show you these guys. Do you notice the one on the far right kind of looks blue? They actually have a genetic condition that malforms. Oh, you've got him there.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. Is he blue like that blue?
He looks pretty greenish.
Actually, he's a little bit more light to the left. He's not quite as dark. He's probably just a little bit lighter than the one on the left.
Wow.
But, I mean, he's dark.
Does he share what his condition is?
I can't remember. I think he has, but I can't remember what.
What is his that?
He probably don't do anything.
We were talking about the stuff in class, right? That guy on the far right actually has a genetic condition that makes the hemoglobin malformed, and it really is a true blue color from malformed hemoglobin. Can't transport adequate oxygen, but it comes from a certain region of people living in Kentucky. So it's called methemoglobinemia. And let's say that one five times fast.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But, you know, that's actually a case where it is a hemoglobin malformation that caused that blue coloration.
Does it hurt or cause health problems?
I don't think so. I think their bodies have adapted to being able to function with it. Otherwise, it would have eliminated them probably before birth.
So they're not ill or anything? Because he looks ill.
Actually, no. I don't think they're not sick from it or anything. I think they're able to cope with it. It's probably like having a form of anemia in a way, by not being able to transport adequate oxygen. Yeah.
Probably tired all the time.
Probably so. Yeah. Let's see. Jaundice is another coloration issue that comes from a liver or gallbladder issue. The problem here is that bile can back up in the bloodstream, which is not a good thing. Bile should be excreted in your feces and broken down by your kidneys. So if it happens to back up in your bloodstream, we know to point the finger at either liver and or gallbladder. Now, it too can cause yellow coloration for a month's time, because once the bile is in the skin or the eyes, then it takes at least a month for that coloration to be removed from the skin. You may have had or heard of situations where babies are born with physiological jaundice, and that comes from the lack of a first bowel movement. That means that the bile backs up into the bloodstream. Once that baby starts having his or her bowel movements, then that helps the bile flow out in the feces as it should. You may have heard that if babies are put into the sunlight, that can help them break down and get rid of physiological jaundice. There happens to be just a light component to bile that it responds by breaking down in the presence of sunlight. They could also put babies under little lamps that help to do the same thing. So break down the bile in the skin, and that pigmentation will be flushed out of the body quicker.
And I have a question.
Sure.
Is it, the question for why do you think we sometimes appear with lack of oxygen?
Lack of oxygen, yeah.
You see that in a lot of hepatitis patients as well?
That's right, yeah. This is an adrenal gland disorder called Addison's disease, and this particular disorder comes from an adrenal gland insufficiency. There's a couple of hormones you'll learn about in Bio-211 that help us to regulate blood pressure and sugar regulation. So when a person hyposecretes or doesn't make enough of those hormones, one side effect is skin bronzing or tanning. And so they think that JFK had this condition back in the early 1960s. Now, he was out in the sun quite often doing things like golf, which may have made him tan anyway, but we do think that he also had that condition, which can cause a skin bronzing effect. Addison's disease can also cause skin pigmentation changes. You know, normally we don't go outside to sun our gums, so if you see pigmentation changes on the gums, that may be all the warning sign that you get from this particular disorder. So more Addison. See that up here, that skin pigmentation? That can be a sign of Addison's disease. Okay, so what's wrong with the case of vitiligo? What is missing from the skin?
Melanin.
Melanocytes, good. They're not producing enough melanin, and it seems to be a progressive disorder where more and more skin cells lose their melanin. Now, the problem with this is, what is he at higher risk for?
Skin cancer,
yeah. This guy is actually a newscaster, and they showed him on TV one time putting on layers of makeup. Once he was on TV, you would never have a clue that he had vitiligo, but it's a progressive disorder. They have found that vitamin B12 shots can help slow the pace of this worsening condition, and this is also what they confirmed is Michael Jackson's disease. So he obviously suppressed his melanocyte production. There is a hormone in the brain that stimulates melanin production by melanocytes. So he obviously shut down that hormone. That's how he was able to have a skin bleaching effect all over his entire body. Otherwise, he would have had patches of missing melanin like this guy has here.
So he was always covered up.
Yeah, with those umbrellas and stuff, yeah. Freckles are a result of sun exposure, and they're also a result of a genetic, just a lineage thing that you can inherit from your parents. So freckles are often related with sun exposure because the more we're exposed to the sun, sometimes those melanocytes get told to stay on and to produce melanin even though there is no sun exposure. So kind of an interesting case there where you can manipulate the genes with excess sun exposure. Later in life, we can, of course, have liver spots or old age spots. You may see these on older people's skin, and that comes quite likely from sun exposure in their younger years. So those melanocytes, once again, get tricked into staying on and producing melanin, and so that's what the dark spots are related to. All right, so what's going on with a case of albinism? They don't produce any at all. There's no melanin here. And so it is a genetic condition that we well understand. It is passed along on a recessive allele. So that means that you can have two completely normally pigmented parents. Those parents have a 25% chance if their carriers are producing a child with albinism. So, you know, you notice here that there is no hair coloration, skin coloration, or eye coloration. The unfortunate side effect for this is skin cancer and eye cancer, since melanin's not present to produce any kind of protective services.
I don't know if that affects the eyes.
Yeah, and it makes their eyes track back and forth too. There's a related disorder that comes with it. Why don't we pick up with dermis on Wednesday? I'll see you guys Wednesday then.